Welcome to Funds That Won, where we dive into some of the world's most renowned investment funds. We'll interview investment managers across the alternative landscape and learn how they built their million and even billion dollar asset management empires. We'll explore teams, structures, strategies, and best practices in launching and running alternative investment funds. All right, really excited for today's episode. We've got Clay Gordon with Stout Street Capital today. How are we doing, Clay?
Hey, I'm doing well. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, great to have you. Hey, why don't you start off by giving me the elevator pitch on Stout Street Capital?
Yeah, Stout Street Capital, we're a seed stage fund based here in Denver, Colorado. We are actively pulling out of our third fund. We pride ourselves on being a community-driven early stage fund, investing in sensible risk with outside returns. Primarily focused on the flyover states in Canada, founder of the UNMET conference and VC Day, made about 80 investments since inception in 2017, and just getting started.
80 investments, and has that been through, is that through Fund 1 and 2 and out of Fund 3 aggregate, or?
Correct, yeah. Fund 1, we did 36 companies. Fund 2, we did 31. Made about 15 or so out of Fund 3 with the target to get to about 40 for this current fund.
Excellent. Fantastic. And what's just in terms of size, what's kind of maybe your aggregate AUM or deployed capital?
Yeah, so we have about $25 million in AUM right now. Fund one was more of a test fund with $5 million and then kind of bumped up to $7.5 million. And we're deploying out of a $13 million fund right now, doing about 250K checks into early stage companies.
Okay, so what's your average check size? So it's 250K to how high will you guys go?
Yeah. So we try to be a single check strategy. So it's kind of a 250K no matter what. We have a little bit of cash on follow on, but we would have a preference to be a single check fund. Fund two, we tried investing in a little bit or 100K upfront with the majority of the fund reserved for follow on investments. What we have found is that our ownership is actually larger if we did a single check strategy at the next stage. And so taking the dilution for future rounds, we would actually net a greater ownership percentage in our winners, with a lot of those preferences not meaning anything in our winners. And so we've kind of pivoted from chasing our winners to a single check, let it ride for fund three, because that's kind of where the data had pushed us to.
So, okay, this is an interesting dynamic I'd like to jump into more, because it's basically that you're leaning more into the power law, right? Because if you were to reserve capital for follow-on, while you're betting on your winners, your relative IRR or ROI on those investments goes down because you're putting more money into those investments. Is that like kind of the right way to think about it, or?
Oversimplified, but yes. I mean, ultimately, the follow-on would be coming at a much higher premium for an entry price. And so instead of investing in a $10 million enterprise business, you're investing in a $50 million enterprise business. And so doing 200K at a $50 million enterprise business does not mean the same as doing, let's just say, an added 50K and the $10 million enterprise company, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Your follow-on spread out through your initial checks would net better because some of our winners have grown to the point where the follow-on rounds have been such a high price that it really doesn't make sense to do a small check into a big enterprise valued company.
So you're just fine to take on the dilution at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll take a small hit on the preference stack. But ultimately, some of our winners, they've ultimately converted to common shares because the preferences never came into effect.
Gotcha. So at the end of the day, what stake are we looking at here in your target businesses?
We'll usually own about 2-3% of the company, still relatively small, more of a function of our AUM than anything else.
And that's post-dilution. So upon entry, you're coming in, or is that?
Yeah, that's entry. Entry is about 2-3% ownership. And then, so that'd be like a 250K check into a 10 million post-money valuation of a company. And then upon exit, so we just had one of our best exits. The company sold for about 120 million. I think we had about 1% after the dilution of a large Series A round without participating.
Well, it's a little, I love it. I mean, it's a little contrary to a lot of it seems like the main street dialogue right now is, hey, invest more into your winners, right? Double down on your winners and participate. Let those investments ride. You said that the data told you otherwise. And when you're talking, I mean, can you give me a little more color there? Is that on your historical investments data? Is this off industry data, or, you know, where are you extracting that?
I would say that's on our data, and I would say our data would be very comparable to, I would say, the vast majority of other early stage businesses. I mean, ultimately, the price that you're getting into at early stage, I'm just using round numbers, and it'd be easier to do this on a whiteboard. And so a average deal, if you say that, is we're investing $250,000 into a company valued at $8 million pre-money valuation, raising $2 million, so a $10 million post. Our ownership would be 2.5%. I would say averages or ideals, a company would raise their next round anywhere between 30 to 50 million pre-money valuation. And so you'd get, you know, roughly a 3 to 5X on paper. Let's just say the company raises 10 million on maybe like a 40 million pre-money valuation. And so you take a 20%, 25% hit on dilution. But if you're going to invest at that stage at a 40 million pre-money, those dollars are not going as far as if they would have just been at the 10 million or at the previous round. Again, it's a lot easier if you just put some numbers on a whiteboard, but articulating it is just a little bit different. And so anyways, we ran some numbers on some of our winners to say, hey, and I can elaborate later on the podcast, but in our opinion, it is difficult to see which one of these companies are going to succeed. Again, this is a high risk asset class of seed stage investing, yeah, but the companies should warrant at least a 10X potential for our investment to offset some of the losses, and you kind of average in about a 3 to 5X from a fund return. But for our winners, when we had done the math, just putting a little bit more up front and letting it ride with the dilution, we have found drive a higher ROI than if we would have reserved cash for our follow-on. And so I would say for the early stage venture class, the Series A investors are usually looking for about a 2 to 3X, really not taking any zeros in their fund. And the seed stage investors would be looking for a 10X, but you're going to have some zeros in the fund.
Right. Let me ask you this. Do the economics still hold at if you double, triple, or quadruple your check sizes and your aggregate fundraise?
Yeah. So there's a lot of, practical complexities that come in with the check size. And so going back to my example of an average company valued at 8 million enterprise value, raising 2 million in new cash, our check is 250. For the most part, it is very easy to squeeze in a 250K check into a $2 million round. But if our AUM was, 10 times what it is now, and our entry check is 1.5 million, is a lot more difficult to fit a $1.5 million check into a $2 million round. So you see company or funds that raise larger funds have to go downstream because their minimum check to deploy into companies has got so big. And so I would say we are a very lean and nimble fund that can squeeze into a lot of these rounds. And I would say, from PitchBook, the data does show that smaller funds do drive higher ROIs. Because of this nimble factor, they can really kind of squeeze into any of these rounds. And again, these successful, very small funds end up raising a lot more money. And the ROI for fund managers is, I would say, higher as the AUM goes up as well. But then the returns would go down just because the minimum check size for some of these large funds becomes so big. It's just difficult to deploy $5 to $25 million checks instead of what our check is today, which is 250K.
Gotcha. And so what does the future look like for Stout Street Capital? Are you guys, planning on staying at the size that you're at now, or do you plan to, scale the economics, or what are you guys thinking?
Yeah. I mean, we would love to scale. We would love to scale. There is a lot of benefits to getting to 50 million in AUM or more. There's just a safety from management fees and expenses. You can kind of leverage a little bit more resources into companies as well. Also, a check size into company does matter. There is the practicality of building a track record, showing limited partners that you can pick the right types of companies to drive good, significant returns to be invested in. And so I would say, this is our year 7. We're still building our track record. We're getting some of these great wins, but ultimately, cash returned is more important than, paper returns or write-ups from companies. And so we're trying to build a, I would say, a firm that is predictable from a return profile that is scalable. And so that's kind of what we're doing right now.
Gotcha. That's great. How did you get to the point of starting this business? What made you want to go out and say, "Hey, let's run a venture fund?"
It was spontaneous would be the word. I had synced up with my partner at a family office here in Denver. We were working with a couple other high net worth individuals on actively investing into early stage private companies, and we had saw a very recurring theme as far as usually high net worth individuals are half retired, but they still want to be in the office, looking at opportunities. But their deals or the companies that they invest in is a function of the deals that they had access to. And since they're not sourcing deals 100% of the time, they had a more limited opportunity base to select from. Usually it's, a friend's son or it's someone that they used to work with. And those were the opportunities that they were choosing from. And overall, we saw this very, very, I would say, qualitative way of investing to say, I have a really good feeling about this entrepreneur. Experience does matter, but it really is betting on a person more so than it is betting on a business model. And we just felt like that was not predictable from a return profile perspective. And so we wanted to really do the opposite, which was one, the fund really is a function of their deal flow. And so we spend tons and tons of time cultivating quality deal flow sources, and then ultimately evaluating the businesses with ultimately the operator meaning a lot to the company. But we did want to see at least a business that was generating some revenue as opposed to just an idea in a garage with a go-to-market strategy. And so at Stout Street, we invest in all post-revenue companies. And even though it is a startup and far from where the company will be upon exit, there is customers that we can talk to and ask, why are you buying the product? And get a sense, is this product valuable or not? And again, this is kind of where we go back from, what is the right type, the right amount of risk for early stage investing? And at least for us, we're willing to pay a little bit higher of a price, knowing that a company does have customers that are willing to pay for the product.
Yeah. Well, how'd you get to the point where you actually said, let's start a fund? Like, what's your background that led up to, getting in and syncing up with this family office partner?
Yeah, so I would say there's two different stories. There's me and then my co-founder. So my background is very different. I was a fundraiser for a nonprofit on the East Coast for about 4 years. It was a little bit more of a corporate experience, which I thought was good, especially out of college. But it was much more centered around community building and then ultimately fundraising, which I feel like sales is just such an important role in life in general. And I just really needed to go through that as a young professional. Growing up in Colorado, I had always seen Colorado tech as the future. And then syncing up with my partner, who's coming from a quant background at a hedge fund, just looking at some more quantitative measures to make investments. And then at least where we were, the broader portfolio that we were tasked to support, I would say had really good allocation in oil and gas and real estate. But when it came to private equity more broadly, there wasn't as much of a concrete approach. And then that in conjunction with, I would say Colorado tech is booming. I would say it's really growing and there's just tons of opportunity. It was just a really good opportunity to say, hey, let's do an early stage fund focused on mostly tech companies or companies with leaner business models, and let's just try it out. And so we kicked it off with, a small fund, hitting up friends and family, and
What was your first fund size?
5 million.
5 million. Awesome. And what was the hardest part about kicking off with a $5 million fund?
I would say, at least in venture, maybe in business in general, it's all about relationships across the board. And I would say it took us a full 2 years to find our relationships. I mean, so we invest in less the capital markets or capital scarce markets, flyover states. And so building deal flow that comes from, 30 plus states just takes time. And we start local
Yeah.
with Colorado, but there's a lot of people here in Colorado. that are great investors, they just, you know, have a different fund thesis than us. And so even though we'd love to work with them, you know, our business models are just slightly different. And so it just kind of takes time to gain that experience. And so I would say it took us a full 2 years to build the deal flow engine, and then sort through some just initial relationships. That has matured over time. And then fast forward a couple of years, we were able to layer on some value add activities, such as our conference, which is the Unmet conference that really helps these companies get access to larger institutional capital. But relationships and then kind of finding where we fit within the venture market just kind of takes some time.
Yeah. So sorry, I'm going to double down on that question. So how long did it take you to raise the first $5 million?
6 months, but again, we knew that it was going to be all no. So it was kind of friends and family and then like start deploying. Yeah.
Gotcha. So initial friends and family, you were probably targeting a higher raise, or how much were you just targeting five?
Yeah, I would say we'd be targeting 10, raised five. Yeah. I mean, more is always the answer, but it's an easy answer, but yeah.
And did you start deploying after that initial 6 months, during that initial six months, or like what was kind of from a scheduling perspective, how did you guys think about it?
Yeah, it was right at that six. I mean, we took first close and then started deploying immediately. I mean, we did a little bit of testing as far as the business models that we invested in, from very early stage to some later stage, some consumer, some health tech or companies that would require, you know, FDA regulation versus SaaS business models. And then ultimately found what is our thesis now, which is investing in companies that improve efficiencies. It's mostly B2B SaaS business models, companies generating a little bit of revenue. And then we're a little bit sensitive to round size and then entry price as well. So going back to that average deal of a $2 million raise that usually gets companies at our stage about 18 to 24 months runway, stuff like that matters to us. Again, kind of where we invest, capital is a little bit more scarce. And so the burn of some of these companies were pretty sensitive over. But yeah, we started deploying right away.
I mean, and how long did it take you to deploy that first five?
The first one was pretty quick because we really needed to enter the market. So two years. Yeah.
Well, no, that's phenomenal. I mean, look, and then obviously you rode the waves of those assets to go out and, you know, move on and raise fund two and then subsequently fund three, right? It's just been an organic, you know, build, it sounds like, which is the way to do it. It just, you know, a lot of people don't realize it just takes time, you know, there's not a lot of shortcuts in this industry that you can take unless already got institutional capital that is going to give you money, but otherwise it just takes a little bit of time.
Yeah, this is where probably venture is very different than some of the other asset classes that is on this podcast as well, as venture is one of the most longest term asset classes that is there. The returns do need to justify it, so you are expecting outsized returns given the illiquidity as well as the long hold time, but it's great. I mean, you're really hoping for an average around 7 years from like a hold time, you know, max being 10, 5 to 10 hold period.
Yeah. Gotcha. No, that's phenomenal. Okay. And so, was it just you? Now a little bit on the team side of things, if I can pivot here, it was just you and your other founding partner. Did you bring on employees? If so, when, what hires were those? I'd love to talk about some of those dynamics.
Yeah. So, hiring is very interesting, very challenging. I would say we got very lucky. We had hired an intern from University of Denver that's really close to our office, Cindy Ho, and she's been wonderful. She's been with us for about 4 years. We've kind of promoted her all the way up to junior partner as well. Just, you know, feel really, really lucky with the hire. We've tried some other things as far as hiring some part-time in hopes that it would equate to full-time, or some contractors for some side work as well. I would say it's been difficult to find people with a culture fit, and then people that can help grow the organization in a way that is a different skill set that would be in addition to the fund as well. And so ultimately, after some lessons learned, I think we're good with the three-person team. As we raise more funds, we want to bring on some more full-time people. but the part-time is just a little bit difficult because there's a lot of people that want to enter the VC market from a jobs perspective. And so we just want to be sincere on making sure that an opportunity is there if we choose to hire someone part-time, that they would be able to transition full-time. And at least right now, that is not where we are. So.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, cool. So it was primarily just, and it sounds like they were helping originally on the deal side of maybe deal screening, deal vetting, and setting up, due diligence calls with you and your partners. That sound about right?
Yeah, I would say a little bit of everything. Operations is pretty broad, and for a three-person fund, it's a little bit of everything. Investment
Yeah.
side, operations. I would say Cindy's really gravitated more towards our events and community outreach, which is more of like our value add. We help on that, and then she helps on the investment side. But I would say her skill set is probably a little bit more on the community and organization front, at least right now.
Gotcha. And is it how do you and your business partner think about investment decisions? Do you guys have to be both unanimous, like all in on it? If one of you guys maybe isn't sold, can the other say, "Hey, no, I'm doing this deal anyways." Like what do you what's the dynamic there?
Yeah, I would say there is a want for it to be unanimous. I mean, with two people, I think it's fair if one person has difficulties getting there from an investment perspective, the person with more conviction should be able to get the other person over the line. And if they can't, then I feel like that deal should be passed on. It is different because we each come from very different backgrounds. We get excited about different things, but ultimately we want to have a very diversified and balanced portfolio. That I think is a representation of the general partners. And so I think all that is very healthy. Our thought process, again, for just the limited time that we have, is ultimately we don't want companies to go to zero. We understand that venture is definitely a high risk asset class, and a lot of startups, regardless of anything, cannot predict COVID or other traits that might end up leading the company to zero. But we feel like there's enough data out there that can show that investing at a certain stage of companies, that the company will not fail. I mean, it's not going to have a great exit, but ultimately we should be able to get our money back investing at where we invest. And so when we pulled the data, it's going back to the early days, we saw there is some common characteristics of early stage companies that were attributed to success. Revenue being one, capital raised being another. This really equates different from venture backable and a general small business, and then time in market as well. A lot of companies fail their first year, a lot more fail their second year, but if a company can be around for its third year, have revenue raised at least $1 million going into a $1 million round, then the stats prove that that company is far less likely to go out of business than companies that have been in business for a couple of years, have revenue and have access to capital or investment. Those companies have a drastically higher chance of success. And so a couple other kind of macro trends as well. The majority of venture exits is between $150 and $250 million in enterprise value. The billion-dollar companies definitely hit the news and it is, great, but those are very, very rare companies. And so having an investment philosophy that just goes after billion-dollar companies, you're chasing so few companies. We just felt like the data was pointing us in a direction to invest in companies that have a higher chance of selling between 150 to 250 million. And so if we can equate investing, again, companies that have been around a little bit with revenue going to investment that might have an exit at 150 million, can we back into a pre-money valuation? And that would drive 10x plus venture returns. And so, can we de-risk our initial investment as much as possible? Going back to how much capital is around the table, is there the right relationships around the table? And so, that's what we do now. Is we try to de-risk the stage, which is the most important part of the business to us. Can we de-risk that investment as much as humanly possible? And then we'll invest in 40 companies because ultimately, some of these companies don't pan out, and some companies that, were less flashy at the time of investment end up killing it. So we want to be kind of practical on, you know, the theory of large numbers. So, yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, you've brought this up a number of times about these events that you hold. I'd love for you to chat a little bit about that. You know, you kind of said that's part of your strategic value proposition. Tell me more.
Yeah. So, you know, differentiation is a big part. I would say there's two main problems for early stage companies that we come across, and it's access to talent and it's access to capital. You know, we help on the talent piece, but it is very difficult. On the access to capital, we do feel like we are in a unique position to at least help create solutions around access to capital. And so we created the Unmet Conference to fill an unmet need of raising institutional capital in capital scarce markets. A lot of times there are states that have, let's just say, 20 or fewer institutional VC funds. And for a startup that is looking for capital, if you go to these funds, and some are late stage, some are early stage, and if those funds say no for whatever reason, then chances are that founder is better at running their company than they are at networking outside of their state with institutional investors. But this is my day-to-day. This is the majority of what I do, is just talking to other investors around the country, seeing what deal they are. We can aggregate these co-investors or downstream investors for our fund and put them in a conference that would be different than the other conferences in the venture market. So there are early stage conferences such as Techstars and Angel Capital Summits around angel groups. That is usually a stage before Stout Street Invest. And so we wanted to be purely institutions only past the angel stage. I would say pre-seed through Series A. And then we need to have enough companies that would attract a lot of investors to get on a plane to travel. And so we usually select 50 companies. We usually have about 200-ish companies apply for these 50 spots. The types of companies are usually B2B SaaS companies with revenue that have raised capital from, you know, institutions previously, just so to make sure that they succeed, but that abundance of companies really helps drive the demand or the VCs to participate. And then we will pre-schedule one-on-one meetings, very similar to speed dating, between startups and companies. And usually a startup, we can help them get, I would say, 6 to 8 one-on-one meetings with investors that they had not met previously. And so for our last conference, that was our 9th conference, which was in Seattle, Washington, the state of Washington under the governor's office sponsored that conference for the investment into Washington-based companies. We helped support 400 one-on-one meetings. And so for these founders, it is free. You know, they get access to these purely for us, you know, trying to be helpful to the ecosystem. It helps from a brand building perspective. Some of our companies participate. This is in our value add. In addition to our 250K check, this is where we want to be helpful. And it's been wonderful. I mean, we've had 4 different state entities sponsor these conferences between New Mexico, Arizona, Ohio, and Washington. And this is our 9th conference. And so, again, this is where we want to differentiate ourselves from our peers to be really helpful to these companies as they try to raise larger institutional capital.
Gotcha. And so then you basically, the value prop is you're just going to get a bunch of VCs in the room that at higher rounds that'll write the bigger checks that can help these companies on their race.
Yeah. Yeah. So we usually have about 50 to 75 VCs participate. I mean, you know, by mandate, we have to deploy the capital that was raised by the funds. And they're always looking for what deals that they should be investing in. There's also a lot of value getting to see your peers. So co-investors or funds getting to meet other funds as well. But ultimately, a company that is successful in raising venture capital, you know, seed stage, Series A, Series B, the likelihood of success for these companies goes up enormously. And so if companies are not able to raise outside investment, then it's usually a negative sign and the company really needs to pivot to manage spend, revenue. So yeah, investment does matter. So.
Love it. That's awesome. Clay, if I can ask you a broad question here, what's something that you know now that you wish you knew when you just started out in this industry?
I would say when I'm asked this question, on panels, what I say in a very respectful way is I would challenge people to push back against, to have their own experience. I feel like it is very common for people to think about people with big reputations in the venture market. From our experience does not match the reputation that is being echoed in the industry. And so, this can go from, public figures or, local figures, but I would encourage people to have their own experience, because everyone wants to get to know the very influential stakeholder in their local region. And I would say a lot of our experience did not match the reputation that they have in the market. And so that is what I wish I would have known back in the day.
Wait, sorry, can I ask you to go like further on that? I'm not entirely.
I'm trying to put this in the clearest way possible. I would say it's just more have your own experience with relationships.
Yeah.
So again, when we start out, everyone kind of goes to the big shots in their industry. And we had just felt like that was not an approach that was going to be beneficial for us. We
Are
really,
you saying the big like funds or big investors or like?
yeah, the big stakeholders, really. So like anyone in the venture market with a huge reputation, you probably seek counsel or advice or help. I have found it more beneficial to do my own thing as opposed to cater to people with big reputations.
Gotcha. No, that there we go. That's what I was looking for. That's great. So yeah, no, because it's true. I think a lot of people, you hear these banner stories or the ones that are always talked about, and you're like, that's the way to do it. I need to go get that experience. I need to go get that job first, and then I need to do that, to enter this industry. But you're saying kind of, carve your own route and take the industry on by the horns.
I think there's this thought is, if you go to this one person, then they're going to make work easier. And I feel like that's not the case. I feel like you just need to kind of create your own reputation as opposed to hoping someone with a larger reputation is going to make the path easier for you to travel.
Well, Clay, I ask this on every podcast. The name of this show is called Funds That Won, where we interview investment managers that are winning. So what would you say is kind of the key? What makes a fund win, to put it simply?
I mean, without saying returns, which has got to be the first answer, I would say survivability. I mean, ultimately, you need to find something that is valuable to the industry. And I feel like it is adapt or die. And that survivability, I think, is incredibly important for early stage businesses and emerging funds to find a way to adapt to new innovations to create value. And so, we have to find what works. Otherwise, there's no need for investors to invest. But I would say this survivability, we really want to hang our hat on, that it's really about persistence, this willingness to learn, this determination. But I would say this survivability, if you're in market long enough, you're going to figure it out. We really want to hang our hat on that.
Fantastic. Hey, what habits do you have that you feel like have contributed to your success?
I mean, for me, I try to be incredibly organized. I try to be very professional. I try to be logical. The emotion part is difficult to take out of the early stage market, but I think this is where Stout Street is very effective. Going to your back to your earlier point on does a deal need to be unanimous or not? I feel like as long as I don't speak from a place of emotion to say I feel so passionate about this opportunity, we have to do it. But to really have that as maybe the final talking point when it comes to an investment decision, but saying like, where are the facts? And I really need to check my emotion when it comes to an investment decision. I feel like that is incredibly important. I think our team, and I'm just going to keep it with me, does a very good job saying, hey, this is the opportunity, and I really need to disconnect my emotion from this opportunity. And if I can't justify the investment, then it shouldn't be made, regardless about how passionate I feel about it. I feel like or myself, I think I'm really, really persistent, showing up at all the events. I feel like I really respect even all the small events as well. I think I'm there for the right reasons. Not there for the open bar, stuff like that.
Nice. Love it. Hey, what investing or industry pet peeves do you have?
This is where we differentiate ourselves as well. Ultimately, we want to build a system, an investment system or process. And so if you stepped into Stout Street, you could be a general partner at Stout Street because we would give you a system that we know works, as opposed to being a more GP focused fund where it's, Clay's investments are X, Y, and Z because he has a good feeling. There's no system behind it. And so we really want to build the system so anyone can step in, use our system, and succeed. Very similar to like a franchise model. And so if I wanted to create a McDonald's tomorrow, McDonald's would give me a playbook on how to operate that. That is what we want to achieve at Stout Street. And I think we've done a very good job. And that kind of devalues the general partner or even my role, but it makes it very clear on what do we invest in, what do we not invest in. And even though Clay Gordon wants to invest in this company, that's not a fit for Stout Street. And so that keeps us, in my opinion, very professional, very institutional, and just very clear.
Got you. And that takes, look, I can respect that. Like, that takes a long time to build out. That doesn't happen overnight, but putting those standard operating procedures in place, especially from a like an investment policy statement, that takes some serious time and effort to put your practices down on paper. So kudos. But you're seeing the benefits of that, or because sometimes I talk to managers and they feel like over systemization can lead to just restrictive, missed opportunities. Do you know what I'm saying? So do you ever just see the flip side of that?
Sometimes. I mean, yes, you're right. I would say in venture, there is too much opportunistic, and I think there should be more disciplined. I mean, if you go to an asset manager that invests in public stocks, chances are they are very clear on breaking down what a portfolio should be for a high net worth individuals. And I feel like that discipline should be put on early stage venture capital fund managers because it is very opportunistic. I can invest in really whatever I want because I think it's a good opportunity. I just see no repeatability going back to the system portion, and I see no predictability from like a return profile. So like my fund three versus fund four, at least with these systems, is very predictable from a return profile, fund in and fund out, which I believe that is what investors are looking for, as opposed to fund three was really good, fund four was really bad because there's no system. So yeah, there is trade-off not being opportunistic, but I feel like at least the asset class that I operate in, I feel like some systems are overdue.
Gotcha. Hey, great. Clay, thank you so much for your being generous with your time today and telling us about Stout Street Capital.
Loved it. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, fantastic. All information shared are solely the thoughts and opinions of the author or guests. Content is for educational purposes only. Do not take any information from the show as financial, investment, tax, or legal advice. Seek counsel from a licensed professional before taking action in any business pursuit. We're not selling or soliciting a security in any way, shape, or form. The host may maintain positions in securities discussed on this podcast. Guests on the show may be current or historical clients of Fund Launch Partners, or Black Card Capital Partners.